This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
AB 32 certainly has been helpful to us because it's helped to shape a lot of the favorable policies and incentive structures that allow more solar to get sited and built. And not just solar, but wind and other forms of renewable electricity.
How do we advance sustainable practices in a world driven by the profit motive? Public policy that mandates the use of renewables by private companies is one way. Not surprisingly, though, this sort of approach is often blockaded by those private interests. Today on Sea Change Radio, I talk with Ezra Garrett, the Chief Sustainability Officer from Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E. A private company that appears to be getting out of the way of sustainability advocates. This is no small matter, given that PG&E has a veritable monopoly in California, the nation's most populous state. I ask Mr. Garrett about PG&E's track record on sustainability, what they're doing to get to the mandated threshold of 33% renewables within the next 7 years, and whether they feel more comfortable backing policy or backing off from politics altogether. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Ezra Garrett. He's the Chief Sustainability Officer for PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric Company. Ezra, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
First, for listeners around the country, why don't you tell us what PG&E is and give us a quick little history of the company, if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. PG&E, we are the gas and electric service provider to 15 million Californians, representing 1 in 20 Americans. So it's a footprint that we serve that includes Northern and Central California. And our company is about 107 years old, 108 years old. We started in 1905, and we actually have predecessor companies dating back 150 plus years. So in a lot of ways, the history of the state of California is the history of PG&E. And really, as the company, as the state sort of population grew and the economy grew, we were tracking with that, with the growth of our company, laying down the electric and gas infrastructure to make sure that that population growth and economic growth was sustained. And so it's really interesting if you go back and look at old San Francisco Chronicle advertisements about our company. It was really all focused on supporting economic growth. And it's a really unique responsibility that we all feel. We have an obligation to serve. We're very heavily regulated by the California Public Utilities Commission. 22,000 employees that we have here in the state all live and work in the neighborhoods and communities that we serve. And so for us, it's a very unique responsibility that we take to ensure that the future of the service that we provide is ensuring a sustainable energy future for our customers, because it's very important here for them, for our regulators, for the elected leaders that we work with, and again, for our employees.
So talk a little bit about your sustainability efforts. How has that evolved, and where do you see it going?
You know, I think that we really saw sort of a step change in the evolution of our company's sustainability program in the mid-2000s. Coming out of the California energy crisis, there was a real bright light shone on the importance of a sustainable energy future. So in the mid-2000s, we worked very hard with policymakers across the state and in D.C. to advocate with others for policies that would help us to, again, lay the groundwork for a sustainable energy future. So out of that came AB 32, California's landmark carbon and greenhouse gas emissions requirement, essentially mandating that by 2020, greenhouse gas emissions would be reduced back to 1990 levels. It's been a remarkable journey for us. And although the light was shown on this work in the mid-2000s, you could actually trace our company's involvement in supporting our customers and being more sustainable, more efficient with their energy usage 30 years back. Over that time, once we first started rolling out in a major way energy efficiency programs for our customers, since that time, we've saved our customers over $20 billion in energy costs. And those energy reductions have allowed us to avoid the building of 25 power plants. So it's pretty significant what's been done over the past 30 years. In fact, if you compare Californians against the rest of the country over that 30-year span, our energy usage has remained virtually flat over that period, while the rest of the country is, you've gotten big screen TVs and other energy intensive consumer products. Energy usage for the average American has gone up by about 50%. So, you know, we've got a long, proud history of supporting sustainability here in the state, but it's really only recently that it's getting the attention that we're receiving now.
So what are some of the highlights and the most compelling reasons why you've been able to keep usage steady?
I think probably the biggest single factor is the regulatory environment that we operate within here in California. So as I mentioned, we're regulated by the Public Utilities Commission here in California, we and the other investor-owned utilities. And as part of that, our rate structure is essentially allowing us to be decoupled. So our profit margin is not predicated on the revenues that are generated through electricity sales. In addition, we've worked over that time to develop and refine a series of very strategic incentives for our customers to help to essentially be incentivized to reduce their energy usage. So a lot of the funding that's deployed to our customers in rebates are in large part the reason that they're reducing their energy usage or keeping it low. Over the past 3 years, we've deployed over $1 billion in energy savings and rebates to our customers. That's real money. And I think that that's probably another, you know, major motivating factor for our customers here.
And I'm a PG&E customer, so I kind of know how it works. But why don't you explain to somebody listening in Tennessee how it works in terms of the rebate system and how ultimately people can see real changes in their utility bills from these rebate programs?
Mm-hmm. It's pretty significant. And for us, it's not easy to figure out the math associated with, you know, what is going to be the right incentive from a dollar standpoint, from an ease of use standpoint, what will be the right incentives that will motivate a customer to take action to do something? Because ultimately, you need them to do something.
And you have seasonal ones, too. There's not just one program. There's lots of concurrent programs in place.
Absolutely. So it's really a portfolio of incentive programs, and that portfolio align with, as you mentioned, sort of geographic opportunities. They align with times of the year, seasonal opportunities. They also align with different classes of our customers. So if you're a residential homeowner, something that might resonate with you will be simple lighting opportunities to replace your light bulbs with LEDs or you know, more efficient technologies. And we provide a rebate to that to install those. And it can be pretty turnkey. So a lot of these rebates are automatically taken, you know, at the point of sale. Some of the larger incentives that are geared towards, say, a manufacturing facility or a small business owner like a restaurant, a lot of those will involve a rebate that they'll have to receive after they make that installation for a piece of equipment, say a more efficient boiler or a more efficient stove. And what we do is we have customer energy efficiency reps who will actually work in person with those business owners to help them to understand the payback period for different types of technologies that they might deploy, and to also help them understand, you know, what financing opportunities there might be available to them through third parties. So it's a pretty complex series of steps and strategies that we employ, because ultimately, again, just having the money available isn't enough. You've got to get penetration, and you've got to do that by, you know, having attractive packages, promoting it properly, and having real people available to help sort of walk customers through the process.
When we hear that term clean energy future, we also, as consumers, can glaze over a little bit because there are so many fossil fuel industries that are out there advertising that they're working towards our clean energy future as well. So it becomes almost milquetoast in some respects. But give our listeners an idea, if you can, of the mix of where most of PG&E's customers are getting their energy.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So right now, in terms of the electricity that we serve to our customers, nearly 60% of that energy is free of carbon emissions, which is pretty significant when you consider, again, that we're sending electricity to 1 in 20 Americans. So roughly 20% of that is renewable or qualified as renewable under the state's renewable portfolio standards. Another roughly 15% is from large hydro sources that we own that are also renewable, but they don't qualify because of their size by the RPS definition. And then roughly a quarter of that is from nuclear. And then the balance is generally gas.
And coal is negligible or not a part of at all of your portfolio?
So as far as coal, we retired our coal plants several years ago. However, the CPUC does require all of the investor-owned utilities to procure a certain percentage of our electricity from the open market. And some small percentage of that could come from coal. You can't trace exactly what all of the sources are, but we believe it's probably less than 1% or 2%. You've got the power to open the door.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the Chief Sustainability Officer of PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric Company, Ezra Garrett. Ezra, talk about gas right now. You mentioned gas as a significant part of PG&E's portfolio. While it burns cleaner, it's not carbon neutral by any means. Can you explain exactly where gas is in the mix, how it bolsters your renewable portfolio, and where you see it going forward?
You know, gas is really an important part of the portfolio of energy that we send to our customers. In fact, in the past couple of years, we brought on a couple of gas-fired plants. And this next generation of gas-fired technology is really remarkable. I mean, these plants use 98% less water than previous generation gas-fired plants. And really, the prices that we've seen in terms of gas has been a remarkable drop. And so it's been a wonderful opportunity for us to offset a lot of the early solar contracts that are just coming on that we signed in the late 2000s. And we really see gas as an important bridge fuel opportunity as we look to go into more and more renewables. Renewable prices are coming down, and so I think that gas has really been helpful for us in sort of softening that transition, again, as we have some of the earlier contracts that we sign on the renewable side that are much higher than what renewable contracts today look like.
And you mentioned that renewables right now are 20% of your portfolio?
20% under the renewable portfolio standard definition, or the RPS. But again, in addition to that 20%, we've got about 15% of our own hydroelectric power that we also own.
And how does that stack up against some of the nation's largest utilities? And as a corollary of that question, how much would you lay at the feet of AB 32, which you mentioned earlier?
So for utilities of our size, we are amongst the cleanest, if not the cleanest, from a carbon emission standpoint and from a renewable standpoint. AB 32 certainly has been helpful to us because it's helped to shape a lot of the favorable policies and incentive structures that allow more solar to get sited and built. and not just solar, but you know, wind and other forms of renewable electricity. So that's been helpful to us as we look to go out and secure renewable sources for our customers. But in terms of what our renewable mix looks like now, it hasn't yet been significantly bolstered because of AB 32, the hydro network that we own, for example. Some of these plants we've owned for nearly 100 years. So we've got a pretty significant amount of our portfolio that was already in there before AB 32. But we do think in the next 5 to 10 years, AB 32 policies will make it a lot easier for us to get out there and find or develop additional renewables and to do it at a price that is going to be more palatable to our customers.
It sounds like AB 32 works for PG&E. Explain why PG&E took a surprising stance against Proposition 23. And first, maybe backtrack and explain what Proposition 23 was.
Sure, absolutely. Fundamentally, we were fully aligned with the concept, with the spirit of that regulation, speaking about AB 32. As a utility company, we acknowledge that there was a pretty significant role for us to play in terms of creating a sustainable energy future, given that such a huge chunk of greenhouse gas emissions come from the utility industry. And so we thought that it was a leadership role that we had to play in helping to work with the state and all of the elected leaders, policymakers, and regulators who were focused on this issue with us to help create an environment whereby we and our other utilities could do the best that we can to serve our customers with the cleanest energy possible. So as part of that, when you looked at Proposition 23 that was put on the ballot in 2010, which would essentially, for folks who don't know, would have suspended indefinitely, actually killed implementation of AB 32, and it used a lot of economic development arguments against it. And so for us to step up and take a leadership role in supporting the fight against Prop 23 was a no-brainer because, you know, that proposition really came late to the party. We were having the conversation around AB 32 and greenhouse gas reductions, you know, way back, I think it was in the mid-2000s before AB 32 actually became a law.
But there were some criticisms against PG&E that they didn't put enough financial muscle behind Prop 23, that they took a stance on the environmentalist side but then didn't match what the Koch brothers and their ilk were pouring into trying to reverse AB 32. And on the flip side, Proposition 16 was something earlier that PG&E put $35 to $45 million into, which was trying to allow PG&E to limit competition in certain areas.
You know, a lot of the criticism that we got around Prop 16, we believe was well-deserved, you know, and I think that coming out of that experience, one of the things that we decided that we would not do as a company would be to be as assertive and aggressive in political campaigns like that going forward. So the funding decision around Prop 23, I think, was really driven by what was needed to defeat the measure. I think that once folks understood what Prop 23 would do, and once folks understood that it was primarily funded by out-of-state interests, I think the calculus was pretty apparent that it wouldn't require a multi-million dollar investment from any one company for the thing to go down.
Let's talk for a second now about your carbon offset program. As we're in controversial territory, that's one of the ones that is inevitably open to criticism because nobody's going to be happy with the mix, but I'd be curious to hear how you've approached it. And I think the Climate Smart program was shelved, isn't that right?
Yeah, so the Climate Smart program was the nation's first utility-offered carbon offset program that we piloted and retired after what we believe was a successful pilot at the end of December in 2011. And what we did was we took a lot of what we learned from that program to build what we think could be the gold standard carbon offset program that we would be offered not as a pilot, but sort of in perpetuity for PG&E customers. We have a proposal in front of our regulators right now that if approved, we would roll out and would allow us to make this option available to our customers and do it in a way that would be incremental to what's being built right now. It would be tied to local California-based solar projects that are in the ground. They wouldn't be double counted for our RPS requirements. So the 33% renewables that we need to get to, that wouldn't be sort of, we wouldn't be able to double count that. We could really say that the carbon offsets that are being purchased by our customers through this new green option would be, again, tied to California projects that are in the ground, incremental to what is out there already. And is at a very, very competitive price. They're looking at 10.7 cents per kilowatt hour. So so we're very excited about it. But again, we've got to sort of go through the process with our regulators. But hopefully that will be the future and the gold standard for carbon offset programs going forward.
And that's really what people were pining for. The criticism with the Climate Smart program was that it was overly invested in trees. But I know that the standards, PG&E was fairly handcuffed in terms of its carbon offset program. It couldn't just approach it like a Levi Strauss or a non-public utility would approach it. And trees are traditionally not supposed to be more than 10% of a carbon offset program. That's usually the ideal portfolio mix, but I think it was very high in there. And so people were saying, well, why don't they just invest in clean energy, since they're in the energy business, and this is a way to become more directly invested in those clean energy technologies?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, again, you know, we use that pilot to inform this program. And I think, you know, the rest of the sector use programs like this as a way to inform. So, you know, we took a lot of feedback and we took a lot of good advice on, you know, what the ideal program should look like. When we launched the program, you know, those sort of standards and ideal mix rates weren't really out there yet. And I think that probably a lot of folks sort of, you know, went to school on our program and saw that, you know, hey, you know, trees can be a part of it, but it shouldn't be the basis for an offset program or be the entirety of an offset program.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the Chief Sustainability Officer of PG&E, Ezra Garrett. So let's just look at solar for a second within your clean energy mix. How have you attained the current percentage of solar in your portfolio, and how do you see it evolving?
Just last week, we were really proud to be ranked as the number one utility in solar installations for the fifth year in a row by the Solar Electric Power Association, or SEPA. In fact, one of the really cool data points that they shared in their announcement was that the amount of solar, in terms of megawatts, that we installed last year exceeded the entire top 10 in 2010 in terms of solar installations. So, you know, we continue to be proud of our work bringing solar into our customers. And we've made a couple of relatively modest investments into Sunrun and SolarCity, but really the vast amount of our engagement and involvement sort of in that industry has been to support it through the incentives that we provide to our customers that motivate customers to work with them to install solar on their homes. Or through these contractual relationships that we've established to procure energy from those solar farms so that we can, you know, meet the requirements laid out for us for the renewable portfolio standard. We do have a small portfolio of sort of mid-sized, locally owned solar farms that that we've been bringing online over the past couple of years. So a couple years ago, our regulators approved about 500 megawatts worth of small to medium-sized solar with the goal of building projects in the service area to kind of keep some of the benefits associated with building solar in here with our customer base. So of the 500 megawatts, 250 of it was going to be contracted out to other developers, and 250 of it was going to be owned by PG&E.
So obviously, renewables being a larger percentage of a public utilities portfolio is an important goal, but efficiency from a consumer standpoint is one of the most direct ways that a citizen can help reduce their carbon footprint. How is PG&E working with its customers to try to become more conscious about their usage beyond the rebate program that you mentioned?
That's a great question. First, let me say you're absolutely right that energy efficiency is the most direct and is the best place to start for someone who's interested in reducing their carbon footprint and lowering the emissions associated with their energy use. That's what we tell our customers as well. Start with energy efficiency and then look at renewable. It doesn't make any sense to put solar power panels on top of a home that's very wasteful from an energy standpoint once the power gets in there. So in terms of working with our customers to make the appliances that they use in their home more efficient, again, we have a lot of direct rebates that we provided them, but we also work with many of the big box retailers to develop incentives that allow us to take a rebate for our customer at the point of sale. So they don't have to put up the upfront money and then mail in a postcard and find a stamp to get a $10 check back from PG&E. It makes it more efficient for them to make the decision right there in the store. It's a good deal for the retailer because that's going to potentially drive sales for them. And it's a good thing for us because it cuts down on our processing time and it helps ultimately us to meet our goal of reducing energy usage quicker. In fact, just yesterday, Senator Udall with the U.S. EPA gave PG&E Energy Star's Partner of the Year Award, which is something that we're really proud of. And it was largely for the work that we're doing, working with consumer appliances and retailers to help create incentives for customers like that.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the Chief Sustainability Officer of PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric Company, Ezra Garrett. Ezra, why don't we take off our utility hats for a second and just talk about some of the efforts that you and your colleagues have made in the community and some of the specific programs that you're most proud of.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, one of the other hats that I wear is as the executive director of the PG&E Foundation. I'm also the vice president of community relations. And for us, we really see sustainability as being sort of a core part of the community involvement work and the outreach work that we do with our customers and a key way that we support the neighborhoods that we serve. So environmental stewardship is one of our core funding principles. When we look at community investment opportunities, we are going to be providing over $23 million in charitable grants in the community. Our employees will likely exceed 50,000 hours of volunteer work in the community as well. The work that we do with the California State Parks Foundation around Earth Day is one of the things that our employees are most proud of. This is going to be our 11th year that we've just completed with the California State Parks around projects for Earth Day. We have expanded that effort this year to include a series of community efforts across the entire month of April. So in the past, it was just on Earth Day in April. Now we do projects all month long. And it looks like we're going to probably exceed 12,000 hours in total volunteer service hours, cleaning up parks, rebuilding neighborhood playgrounds, and our employees are pretty excited about it.
The Chief Sustainability Officer of PG&E, Ezra Garrett. Ezra, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by U2, the Steve Miller Band, and the Children's Television Workshop. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability.
For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.